Welcome to South Beach Sessions. This is Dan Lebatard, and I've got a homework assignment for you before you start this. You are not to listen to this until you've gone to HBO Go, if you can. Whitmer Thomas, the golden one on HBO Go. You need to see this special so that you have the context for what it is we're going to be talking about. His album, Songs from the Golden One, is on Apple Music and Spotify, but this is a young comedian who has had a good deal of hardship and does not mind being all kinds of vulnerable. His show is unique. It's artistic. It's dark. It hurts. It's funny. And you should check it out first, The Golden One on HBO Go, before you listen to what's coming here, because then you will have the context that you need. Before we get to Whitmer Thomas, before we get to this conversation, though, a reminder that South Beach Sessions are brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Here is Whitmer Thomas. If you have not seen it yet, you should check out on HBO The Golden One. It is an ambitious comedy project. It is painful. It is dark. It is funny. It is weird. It is whimsical. It is musical. And Whitmer Thomas is at the center of doing it. Went back to a place where his mother, and she seems to be a source of much of his comedy and his pain, went back to the source of where her and her sister were performing, and he has since taken on a life of entertainment. And at a very young age here, he has arrived at a place where he's trying to play with the form a little bit. So Whitmer, thank you for joining us. And I wanted to start by asking you how that comedy special came together, because I'm surprised that HBO even went down the path of entertaining how ambitious that was.
Thank you, man. I had been doing that show, The Golden One show, around for a couple of years in some form, probably for about 3 years. And HBO, you know, had seen it at one point before there was music involved. And I was just doing straight stand-up and storytelling. And, you know, they thought, oh, that's interesting, but I don't know if it's worth a special or anything. And then I had recorded all this music, just like kind of classic guitar, drums, bass music, just because I wanted to record some music. And then I listened back to all the demos of it, and I was just super embarrassed by the lyrics, how sincere they all were. So I changed the lyrics to kind of become more, you know, less metaphoric. If I had a song that was about, like, you know, my mom's alcoholism, I would just, like, very plainly say, I can't party because my mommy partied to death. And I just thought that was funny. So I just started mixing that into my comedy, into my hour of material, into The Golden One show. And I found that it kind of glued bits together a little bit and gave it some emotion. And also it was a nice break to get to sing a song. And then Bo Burnham saw that version of the show, where there was, you know, songs in it. And he was like, we got to figure out how to make this into a stand-up special. And A24, the production company, got involved. And then we took it to HBO. And we were like, the idea for the special is that I would go home and film it, kind of paying homage to my mom at this venue where she used to kind of work and play all the time. And if we do that, there's a good chance I'll have to end up reconnecting with my whole family. And HBO was like, yeah, all right, that sounds ridiculous. Let's figure it out. So it was really quick. It was like within a month we were shooting it.
Did you feel brave doing that?
At the time, I didn't have any time to think about any of that because I was so desperate. It was like, you know, I was just like completely broke, like at the lowest of the low, like in my career, I guess. I had, you know, there had been some like hope for me a few years ago. I had done all the cool comedy festivals that are supposed to be your introduction into this entertainment showbiz kind of world, and then nothing really happened, and my comedy touring agents fired me. And then, you know, I as soon as they were like, okay, go shoot it, I was just like, okay, I got to go make this and try to make it the best thing I can. I didn't feel brave. I just thought, I got to do this, and I have to make it something that resonates with me at least.
What did So Desperate look like? Like, what are some of the details there? Because it is a cool story that you've turned this pain into laughter and you've turned this laughter into art.
I mean, my favorite example of how desperate and broke that I was is like when I was actually filming my comedy special. In order to even get there, I had to drive my car down there, my 99 Camry. I had to get my big brother to Venmo me some money so that I could get the gas to even go to tape my comedy special. And then when I was on stage recording the actual special, I got a notification in between shows. There's two shows that they tape, you know, that my bank account was negative $400-something.
Oof.
So I had to say from stage with like the executives at HBO and all the people asking my big brother if he could Venmo me the money to level out my bank account to zero. And so, you know, that's just financial stuff. But as far as like desperation goes, you know, like just doing, you know, doing that show, the Golden One, to venues where, you know, people aren't really showing up and, you know, touring around and trying to book my own tours and nobody really going and just people not really having any sort of real interest in me. It seemed sort of like just that time had passed, you know. If anything was going to happen for me, it felt like it could have happened about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. But it's just I was ready and kind of had accepted to be like, okay, well, I'm not going to be like a comedian with a cool stand-up special ever, so I might as well just get to know these younger comedians and try to support them and do whatever I can. And so that's where I was at, you know.
Why didn't you give up?
Truly, depression. Like, I couldn't stop comparing myself to my mom. It really hit when Ricky Whitley, who's in the comedy special on stage with me, and he's on stage with my mom too. He sent me that VHS tape of my mom's band playing at the Floribama, and I at first watched it and, you know, cried and was like, oh, how beautiful and cool. And then I was thinking like, wow, look how young she is, and is she happy? Like, she thought she was going to be a star, and there she is playing to all these drunk assholes on the beach at this bar. And like, is that what I'm going to do? And then I was thinking, like, she called me the Golden One, and she, like, I can't, like, fail. I can't. I have to do something because I can't be another person to just, like, to blow it, to let, like, be distracted or to kind of just let it slip through my fingers. I have to figure out how to do something.
I don't know how spiritual you are, but the connection obviously comes through in your work and in the special. Did you feel her presence while you were there doing that show in that specific venue?
Yeah, it was absurd. Dude, you can see it. If you saw the show, me performing that show on the road, you know, it would have seemed like a tight show. There would have been emotion and stuff, clearly, but like, tight, like me telling jokes, me singing songs, me telling stories. None of that me walking around looking at the floor. And I didn't realize that, you know. As soon as I walked out onto stage, I was like, what the I couldn't figure out how to do it, you know. And
what have I done? You're on the stage. You're in the middle of your comedy special. This is your big break after unholy desperation. And you're like, what the fuck have I done?
Yeah. I was like, shit, I should have just done this in a theater like all the other comedy specials. That's the funny way to do this. I felt like walking and doing my music and my jokes, which by no means is like a Southern vibe. You know, it's not like country music, and it's not like...
That's not the crowd. That is not the crowd, right? That is not the audience for your kind of music.
No way. And then I was thinking on stage about my mom kind of doing that same thing, because her music wasn't necessarily country or anything. And it was like just on so many different levels of parallels and so many different levels. And yeah. And then once we got all the footage back and I was looking through it, I was like, oh shit. Like I really blew it. Like I should have taped this somewhere else. If I wanted to look good, you know, if I wanted to look good, I would have taped it at some theater in LA where some people know me. But,
oh no, but you know now, right? That the grungy element made it so much more personal, so much more intimate, so much more true.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, now I'm happy that I did it there. But, it, you know, just for my own ego, it took a few days of me getting used to.
For those of you who have not seen the special, I should probably have Whitmer. How would you describe it in your own words for those who haven't seen it? They'll go check it out after this conversation. But how would you describe it to people? And what are the elements of the story that they need to know?
I'm just a stand-up comedian, and I go back home to Alabama, where I'm from, to perform at a bar called the Floribama Lounge, which is a place where my mom's band was the house band, and I grew up watching her perform there, and she passed away a long time ago. So it's tricky. And in order to kind of get into the doors of the Floribama, I had to reconnect with a lot of members of my family so that I felt like I wasn't, you know, just some like big city brat who's going to go try to milk my culture for whatever it's worth.
And how uncomfortable was the vulnerability and the intimacy of you showing people your life that way? And why do it that way? Why show everybody all of that?
Dude, it was very uncomfortable. I felt like an idiot for a long time. Like, we shot it last summer. It was finished, edited in October, and then it came out in February. So between October and February, I was like, I couldn't sleep. I was like so worried that I had exploited my family and my story. And I felt bad about having my family on camera. And I felt bad about showing the Floribama like in a big, you know, because it's like a little special place. And then I felt like it was like personal in a way that I realizing like, oh, shit, I'm never going to get to be a mysterious cool guy now, like a mysterious bad boy.
So you're on stage, you're struggling with it. You're saying to yourself, what have I done? And where and when within that did you feel strength from beyond?
Looking at my brother, my cousins sitting out there. You know, they had all the same kind of experiences that I did. We all experienced everything in the same way. They were 5 years older than me, 5 and 6 years older than me. But I would look at them and see that, you know, we were kind of all going through it together. And that was cool. And then also my nephew, who's 4, was in the crowd too, watching with his mom. And I remember thinking like, he's 4 and he's getting to watch his uncle on stage, and then his dad's going to come out and play, and like we can like reset this whole thing and make it better, like in our family, you know, that we've had some losses and some tragedies, but maybe now we can kind of reset it. And yeah, I was just trying to think of the positive things that were coming from this, you know.
So on the lonely nights when you're having that remorse of what have I done to my family, what is one of those instances that you look at and say, well, I was feeling great fear and remorse about doing it, but look at how positively it ended up turning around. Look at how little I actually know about what the results of this were going to be that I feared that I shouldn't have feared.
The stuff that people have been saying on the internet about it has been really cool. You know, people sending me messages and stuff. It's been, I just couldn't have expected that people would be so, people have sent me messages saying like, my husband died. He was a musician and my son is 11 and he just started playing guitar and watching your thing made me think maybe one day he might do something like that for his dad. And you know, that like, that kind of stuff. And then at the same time, people reaching out to my aunt and saying like, Sin Twister, your band is so cool. And where can I hear your music? And I, you know, I think, I'm happy that I did it this way instead of just going on stage and not meeting my family at all and not talking to them and stuff, because it allows the audience to humanize them. And you see that everybody's reeling and everybody's grieving. And instead of me just going on stage and talking shit about them, it's just you get to meet them and understand that everybody kind of had their own demons.
And how much healing was there for everybody involved in what it is that you decided to do there?
A lot. There's like 4 or 5 photos on my phone right now of all of us. My aunt and my dad and my cousins and my brother. all in the same place together, like standing together, which we haven't had anything like that in probably 20 years. So there's that. And then there's, I mean, me and my brother have started to like actively play music together. And, you know, my aunt and I have remained in contact, and me, my dad and I have been closer than ever. And then the biggest thing for me is that my aunt found all of their recordings, my mom's band's recordings, all the way back to 1975. So I went and got those digitized, and they were thought to have been destroyed by Hurricane Katrina, but the guy at the digitization place was like, oh, these are 2-inch tape. It's impossible to destroy these. And so I'm remixing all of her old music now, and hopefully we'll put it out in some capacity.
You can get, by the way, I should tell the audience, the Songs from the Golden One, the album, on Apple Music and Spotify. You should check out on HBO Go, The Golden One, Whitmer Thomas, The Golden One. So what has happened here in terms of changing the desperation? Because now all of a sudden this hits HBO, which does almost only good work, has legitimized you. What ends up happening with other comedians? Because it's a small circle, and I'm sure other stand-ups have noticed the bravery and what it is that you did and the vulnerability. Like, who have you heard from where you're like, holy shit, I can't believe that I reached here, this person, in a way that is artistic, that sort of gets exactly what it is I was trying to do?
Well, first, like, Bo, you know, he produced it. So, like, having him involved and his producing partner, Chris Storer, like, they've exclusively made really good stuff. So that was the first thing. And then since it came out, people like Amy Schumer has said some nice stuff a couple times, and Judd Apatow and Sia, the singer, which is really cool. But mostly it's been my peers. I think, you know, as comedians, we kind of do these little showcase shows together. Like, we'll do 10-minute sets around town and run into each other and hang out with each other. But the nicest texts and messages have always been just from people that I started with and that I see all the time, you know. Those have been the coolest, just like my close friends who, you know, normally when people watch me do a 10-minute set around town, I'm not doing some like one-man show about my death of my mom. I'm doing like some stupid jokes, some silly jokes. So I was in a way a little bit embarrassed to be seen in kind of a vulnerable way on stage for my special. And so I was kind of nervous what my peers would think. I was thinking like, oh, they'll think like, oh, this is lame, it's not even funny, or whatever it is. But it's been nice to hear that my friends who I do comedy with regularly have liked it, you know, at least most of them, some of them.
What are the compliments that are most meaningful specifically? I'm not talking about from the people. I'm talking about the words that are said that you are like, wow, that's really cool.
Oh, yeah. Anytime somebody reaches out and says, like, I've connected with this story, like, because of my parents' own addiction or death or you know, those are always the most meaningful compliments. Like, when people watched it not knowing what it was, too, they're just, like, watching shit on HBO, especially now because everybody's on lockdown, like, just kind of scrolling and then clicking on it and watching it. And they said, I didn't know what this was, but then I watched all of it and it resonated with me because I lost my mom a year ago or whatever it is. I feel like those are the best compliments. And those are always the people who are laughing the hardest in the crowd. You know, it was really funny in Alabama. People are hard living down where I'm from. You know, people live pretty hard and pretty fast, and I've done this show all over the place. And the song that I sing called Party to Death, about my mom drinking herself to death, never killed harder than it did in Alabama. People were laughing like crazy at that song and singing it. And at the end of the show, while they were moving camera gear out, they had everybody stay in their seats so that they weren't tripping over cords. And I was just talking to them. And I was like, guys, why? I've never heard people laugh the way that y'all did at Party to Death. Like, why was that so funny? Usually people, that's like a very alienating song for a lot of people, and they don't know if it's okay to laugh. And I was like, clap your hands if you have a dead parent. And I swear to you, 90% of the audience clapped. And I don't know what that's saying about Alabama, but it was very cathartic. It was like, oh, cool. Like, everybody here has going through this. So when some kid from a small town or some person from a small town DMs me on Instagram or Twitter and says something like, you know, they connected, it makes me think of how I was when I was younger. And if I would have seen something that dealt with alcoholism and loss, how I really had such a thirst for that kind of thing. And so I hope that I've like provided something that people like me can connect with, you know.
When did you realize that your pain could be funny? Like how soon? Because you have to have a macabre sense of humor. My guess is that all along the path, for a long time now, you've had to laugh to keep from crying.
Definitely. Yeah. It was never. Yeah. My therapist would say that that's a big problem, but,
because it deflects, because it doesn't actually examine the pain you're going through, you're just camouflaging it.
Yeah, totally. And even as a kid, it would be, you know, my mom, I felt like my mom and my dad's problems were a lot bigger than anything that I could ever experience. So no matter what I was really going through, I didn't really have much of an opportunity to be a brat as a child or to kind of complain. And so all I really could do was just goof off. And I was lucky because when I was a kid, all the stuff that was popular was like Jackass on MTV and bands like Blink-182, where everything was like so extremely annoying, you know? So like that was all the comedy that I loved. It's just these people going like 110%. And so that's what I was trying to do, just deflect, 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 kind of like an addict would, you know, with drugs or something. But with my own comedy, you know, it like, when my mom died, I was 19 or 20, and she wrote a letter saying, she gave me some money. She gave me $5,000. And she was like, don't spend it all on rent. So I was trying to think of what to do with that money. And so I rented out a theater. I'm still spending on rent, but I rented out a theater, which I felt like she would be cool with, to try to figure out how to do comedy and to play videos that me and my friend and my co-director, Clay Tatum, had been making. And so we would play videos and then invite comedians up. And I wasn't thinking of myself as a stand-up comedian at all. And every time I would try, I would just bomb, bomb, bomb. But then I was telling a story just on stage in between about being kidnapped when I was 3. And just because I thought it was an interesting story, not really expecting a laugh, just like, oh, this is something they might think is interesting. And then at the end of it, I said, I guess that guy thought I was pretty cool. maybe he was like my first big fan. And people laughed at that. And that was the first time where I was like, oh, maybe I could kind of explore the darker parts of my life a little bit, because I have this kind of deflecting kind of way of talking about them. So
would you go back and give yourself the advice of spending the money that way, even having seen how it turned out? Because that seems like, of all the ways to spend that money, that's artistically spiritual and connected, but it's also an unusual choice you made there.
Well, she wrote not to spend it on rent. So I kept my job. I was delivering groceries, and I didn't want to let her down, you know, so I just, well, she also said in that letter, like, believe in angels and I'm watching you. And so it was really a strange time, you know, because everything, I just felt like she was kind of monitoring me, and I didn't know what else to spend the money on. I could have, you know, I could have bought a guitar or something, but I just was trying to think of a way to do something where I could be in control, you know, like, it would be my thing, you know? So that's why I spent it on that. I don't know. I guess it is kind of weird. And even Clay, my friend and collaborator, was like talking about it recently. Like, yeah, I remember you just texted me a picture of a theater and we're like, I rented this theater every week. We have this theater every week. We can do whatever we want inside of it. And he was like, well, that was crazy. It just seemed crazy, but we all did stuff in it. So it worked out.
And so as you're bombing and bombing and bombing, are you punishing yourself? Are you thinking to yourself, no, I'm failing and failing is learning? Or what is it that you're doing as you're bombing?
Well, I really loved comedy. It was like something I really wanted to do. I was like obsessed with stand-up comedy and wanted so badly to figure out how to be good at it. And I could be conversationally funny, like if I was talking to a friend or something. But when I was on stage, I couldn't figure out how to get a laugh. Like, and then when I told that joke about being kidnapped, or that story, I realized that I was just having a conversation. And so, I was obsessed with it. It was like, and this is what I tell people if they're thinking about doing comedy. I say, if you go on stage and you bomb your first time and you still want to do it afterwards, after that, like, massive defeat, then you should probably consider doing it. It might be something that you're kind of meant to be trying to do, you know? I wasn't worried about it. It was a nice time, you know? And back then, everything was funny to me. Like, every comedian I saw was the funniest comedian in the world. Anytime I would go to a comedy show where there was 15 people in the crowd, I thought everybody on stage was famous. It was the best time ever. And a couple years into that, into doing comedy, I met Todd Glass. He's a great comedian. And he was doing a recording a podcast with Norm Macdonald. And so I met Norm Macdonald too. And Todd said, oh, this is Whitmer Thomas. He's a young comedian. He's pretty funny. And Norm said, oh, how long you been doing it? And I was like, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. And Norm said, oh man, this is the best time of your whole life. Like, it's never going to get better than this. Like, 2 or 3 years in, everything is great. So don't forget. And I remember thinking, yeah, right, man, this sucks. But looking back, that was the best. It was like everything was ahead of me. It was really exciting.
Who are your influences? Because I don't know that I've seen someone exactly like you. And it sounds from the way that you're telling the story like you might have been trying to be a different kind of comedian, learning from others, stealing from others, and you didn't find it until you realized, oh, no, it's my stories. It's the way that I'm going to do this. This isn't about my influences. I know you got to sculpt it, and there are all sorts of notes that have to get hit in a year, 2 years of sculpting to get the hour of work. But who were your influences, and do you actually follow them now, or are you just doing it your way exclusively?
Yeah, my biggest influences were like Zach Galifianakis and Tig Notaro and people like that. I really wanted to be like a cool, kind of quiet, like absurd comedian. But I couldn't lie on stage. I think that was like a thing is like if people saw me tell something that definitely wasn't the truth, and that was the joke of it, people just never wanted to laugh at it. So like I couldn't lie. So that was my whole journey, was like realizing that I had to be honest in order for shit to work out, in order to get a laugh. Like, and I had to go like all the way. Like if I felt like if my whole shtick was that I seemed like I didn't care, then people would go, ah, screw this guy, he's lame. So like the biggest influences were people that I could never be like. And like realizing that a lot of the comedians that I grew up on when I was a little kid, like Adam Sandler and Jim Carrey and Eddie Murphy, all of their comedy came from some true place and also some like great vulnerability. Even Adam Sandler and like Billy Madison or whatever, it was characters trying really hard and being desperate. And realizing that that's who I am as a person. So maybe just leaning into that a little bit more. But it took a long time, and it took like a year for me to even get like a real laugh on stage.
Those are old comedians for you to use as models. Like you're very young for those to be the guys. Like Adam Sandler is a lot younger than even the other two that you're mentioning. I know that in this community, Norm Macdonald is super respected. Like you must have liked how uncomfortable his style was.
Oh yeah. No. And there was a time period where I remember talking like Norm Macdonald, where I'd always go like, I don't know, you know, just like trying to find my voice. He's one of those guys who bridges the alternative and club thing really well, to where he's like on some other, you know, some other atmosphere. But yeah, I don't know. Those Jim Carrey, Eddie Murphy, I guess they're kind of old, but there's something about that era of comedy that I like. And if you think about it compared to now, it's maybe like almost rude the way that they all were comedians, because they were so just spotlight hogs. Like, they were the only funny thing in a lot of their movies, especially Jim Carrey, maybe not Eddie Murphy and Adam Sandler, but it's been a strange trip as far as influences go.
I didn't realize, though, that you were talking about those guys in the movies. I thought that perhaps you were talking about their stand-ups, which has me viewing you as a six-year-old all of a sudden, you know, throwing in, you know, whatever, Delirious or, you know, Jim Carrey at the beginning before he was, before he became a movie guy. He was exceptional at stand-up comedy.
Yeah, no, but my brother was a little bit older, you know. He was 5 years older, so he was watching Delirious exclusively. My brother, and Delirious hasn't aged well at all, but there is a joke in Delirious that is to this day one of the best jokes ever, and it's about Eddie Murphy waiting for the ice cream man as a kid. And that was the first, I didn't really like stand up as a kid, you know, and then I saw that ice cream man joke, and that was the first time I ever laughed at stand up. Like, I fell on the ground laughing and like couldn't catch my breath. And then, you know, the Adam Sandler things, those CDs, I would listen to those albums as a kid. And Jim Carrey, I don't know if I ever even saw him do stand-up until YouTube came around. But I just mainly mean, like, I guess thinking about him and his movies, I was, you know, like Stanley Ipkiss is from The Mask is like my favorite character that he does. It's because he is so kind of desperate. I just like desperate. I've said that 700 times talking to you.
Why do you like it? Because you just connect with it, because you've been there. You've spent the last 10 years there.
Yeah, I think that I just appreciate when people are openly affected and struggling in art. I really like listening to that. I think it's why I connect with emo music a lot. And I don't know, there's something about characters who just need to connect, and there's no real nihilism. It's just people who want religion or who want something, you know. I'm not religious at all, but I'd rather watch a movie about somebody who's desperate to find religion than someone who is positive that it doesn't exist, you know.
Where, in what clubs or what details do you remember sort of your brand of comedy? You're sitting there and you got to be a little off kilter. You got to like the dark stuff, but you go into a place and there aren't that many people there, and they simply don't get it, don't like it, and it's not for them. Like, you have to have some examples of that. I am surprised to hear you say that Alabama was a place where you connected, but it makes sense when you're talking about the death of parents being a connection point. Where are some of the places that you remember playing where you're like, whoa, that didn't work at all?
I mean, in LA, you know, most of the time when I tour, it's always been good. It's people, you know, some nights are off, there's off nights here and there, but as far as cities go, I feel like do better in middle America places. Like New York and LA is always it's good, but you know, I feel like people have a little bit harder time laughing out here. They're exposed to so much more. And maybe I always say that when I perform in New York, that it doesn't feel like anybody's parents are dead in New York, but they're always good. You know, it's like the worst sets I've ever had have been in LA and New York. Like, just because I'm performing much more in those two places.
I can just see where your comedy on some nights might not land, and it has nothing to do with whether it's funny or not. It has everything to do with the crowd and the crowd not being here for weird, different, eccentric, dark, just wanting something. It's headed to the club because they just want to laugh, and maybe not thinking that it's funny because of how eccentric it is.
Yeah. I mean, there has been definitely has been nights where I've told the kidnapping story and no one has laughed. And then it just feels like I just told a story about getting kidnapped as a 3-year-old. And people are like, why did you tell me that? Australia. I've performed in Australia for 3 weeks, almost every night at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and pretty much bombed exclusively. And they hated it. Like, they hated all the shit I was doing. And I felt, I mean, that was bad. like people would come up to me afterwards and go like, was that all real? And I'd go, yeah, it was real. And they go, oh, mate, I thought you were doing a character.
Whitmer, how much pain have you had in your life that it takes you a minute to remember, yeah, I bombed for 3 straight weeks in Australia, and you can't come up with that story immediately? Like, that sounds horrible. Three weeks of bombing in a foreign country while telling intimate stories and everybody confused as to what the hell you're doing sounds unspeakably painful.
Yeah, dude. I don't know why it took me so long to remember that. I think because I'm feeling pretty good right now, so I forgot about that. But that is one of my – like, Australia just did not get me at all. Like, at the end of my set, they – you know, I was part of this thing. It was my own fault. I should have, like, read it a little better, figured it out a little bit, because I was part of something called American Headliners, where they billed me with two other comedians who were really silly and kind of over the top and both hilarious comedians. And I would go in between them and do these, like, sometimes depressing stories and – just eat it, just bomb. And so I started doing more silly stuff at the end of my sets to where I would go, oh shit, I accidentally did all the wrong jokes. I did my set labeled American set. I was supposed to be doing my set labeled Australian set. And I would read off like really stupid, basic, like, why do you call a flashlight a torch and stuff like that? About like an American in Australia for the first time. And then people would laugh at that. They would laugh at how absurd and stupid it was. And so I started closing my set that way. And then I got a review in The Guardian or some Australian magazine or a newspaper that said, Whitmer Thomas told dark stories to no laughs or something. And then in typical American fashion, forgot his correct set and realized at the end. Like, they didn't understand that that was part of the act. Like, they just did not get me at all, man. It was like hard.
And so you leave there thinking what, right? Because this is not that long ago. You leave there thinking, I learned something there, or I never want to do that again, or?
Yeah, I did. I learned something big time there, which is you got to read the room. Like, that wasn't my show. That I was sharing that show with two other comedians. And I wanted to go out and be the star and do this like one man show kind of thing, you know, this like look at me moment instead of sharing it. Like, I could have gone out and done bits and like, you know, done more of a triple build kind of show, which is what I should have done. But instead, week after week, I wanted to be like, oh, Whitmer Thomas impresses us with his vulnerable, hilarious storytelling. But that wasn't that room. And so that was my own fault. Like, that was my biggest lesson. And like, looking back from Australia, I learned so much. Like, if the vibe is a fun, silly vibe, don't go try to change it to be like the me show. Like, if I would have done a bunch of silly jokes and then peppered in the kidnapping story or the mom is dead story, it would have gone great. But instead, I wanted it to be like kidnapped story first, then that, you know.
You say you're feeling pretty good right now, and I know money doesn't buy happiness, but has success helped in sort of lifting some of the fog of depression? Because that is something that a lot of people arrive, you know, like Tyson Fury, for example, heavyweight champion of the boxing world. He arrives at the mountaintop and just descends right into cocaine and empty and gaining weight because the top didn't feel the way that he thought the top was going to feel. And mental illness and depression are difficult things to combat no matter how much success you're having.
No, it doesn't fix depression. It's hard, you know, like I've struggled with bouts of like depression since I made this special. You know, being able to pay my rent is cool. That's new. but the truth is, the thing about doing this show over the last few years is that it's connected me with my mom in a way that I didn't get to. I never got to like experience her really as an adult, you know? And so doing this show, I felt like this great connection with her. And now that I'm not doing it anymore, it's gone. And I don't feel that. Like, I'm no longer on stage singing about her telling with a image of her singing behind me, like the same, you know? So dealing with that, and, you know, there's always going to be depression and stuff, but as far as the show goes, I made it and it's out and people can watch it and people also can learn about my mom, and that has helped that aspect of it. But, you know, with now I having a little bit of success, and it's not like I've been recognized on the street one time. And you know, that's the extent of it. People on the online have been really cool, but it's not like people are reviewing me in the New Yorker, like, you know, how they do with like Pete Davidson or something like that. Like, you've been nice to talk to me, but it's, I'm still not like a famous comedian by any means. So, you know, there's always going to be a struggle, and I'm not at the top of the mountain, and there's always going to be things that send me back into like a massive funk or depression. And it has helped in the way that right now I don't have to worry so much about paying rent, but also I don't have a job lined up. So maybe I will soon.
I would think that opportunities would present themselves now. No,
I hope so. I mean, I'm trying really hard to have things prepared to give to people. That's the lucky thing about just kind of floundering for the last, however long, years and years, is I've had so many projects that I've written and tried to pitch or something that now people have become a little bit more interested in. So hopefully I'll be able to make a TV show or make a movie or something like that, because I'm ready to. You know, I was thinking, like, having a bunch of money, like, it's, you know, now that I'm 31 now, so like I'm responsible. And the first thing I did when I got paid with my money from HBO is I bought a Subaru Outback because my car was broken. And then I was like, well, what else do I need? I need to fix some things up around the house. And I was like, oh man, getting a big paycheck when you're in your 30s is like not as exciting as it would have been when I was like 20. Mm-hmm. That's the time to be rich, is be like Timothy Chalamet and like making out with some model on a boat. Like, that's when you're supposed to get to be rich, you know? But instead I'm like, what do I need? I could use a rug.
Are you, when you're done with a show, I'm wondering the level of drain. Is it because of performing and adrenaline and fear and all of that stuff? Or is it because you're visiting an emotional space again and again and again that hurts, and the performing of it, you're feeling it as you do it? I don't know that you parse these things, but when you're done with a show, what is that? What are you feeling in the green room?
Yeah, emotional. It's weird. It's like I feel a little bit numbed out, honestly, like singing that He's Hot song, as ridiculous as it is, with my mom on the screen. And sometimes if I was in California, my brother would come play with me, and so I would be with him, because my brother lives out here. He lives on a school bus in Carpinteria. So you just kind of zone out. But then, you know, the more that I would do it, the more that I did the show, the more people started to show up. Sometimes I would sell out a venue, and before I could even make it to the green room, people would come up to me, and you know, I could see on their face, like, oh, this person has a dead parent, or, you know, and they would come up to me and talk to me. And that was what I would end up doing, is just talking to people about our shared experience. So that was like probably better than the emotional drain. I don't know if I had an opportunity for that until I shot the stand-up special and edited it. Then the emotional drain came. Then I couldn't sleep at night and stuff.
You shot past something there, like if it were a nonchalant speed bump. Did you just say your brother lives on a school bus? That's something you just said. He lives on a school bus.
Yeah, my brother's a surfer. He has a business in Carpinteria, which is right by Santa Barbara. But he's a surfer, and him and his wife and their 4-year-old son they're pretty bohemian. And so he built a school bus to be a house. It's really, it should be on HGTV. It's like beautiful. It's got all the things you would ever want inside of it's like a big old, big Airstream kind of, you know, but it's a yellow school bus. And they live on it near Rincon Point in Carpinteria. So until, you know, they're trying to figure out what they want to do before their son has to go to school. But yeah, it's really cool. And you see it for a second. He lives in Alabama for the summer. So he drives a school bus down Alabama. So in the stand-up special, you can see it for a second when I'm like holding a sheet in front of my nephew and making him disappear. They're on the school bus, but we did a whole tour of the school bus, but we cut it out because we didn't have time for it.
Anything else that you cut out that you wish you hadn't?
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff. There's, just a lot of stuff we didn't have time for. There was a whole segment of me and my friend Clay trying to fish and trying to do stuff that like Alabamians do that we kind of felt we were too punk to do. Cause we were so into skateboarding and stuff like that. So we like go fishing and you see us that we don't really know what we're doing. And then, we go try to shoot a gun, which is kind of in it for a second. And then, there was a moment where I got Clay to act like my publicist to try to get me on a radio show interview to try to get people to come to the Fort Bama. Because like, that's the other thing. And nobody bought it because he sounds like a 12-year-old with a cold. So everybody said no. But that was the other thing that like, I'm not known at all, especially down in Alabama. So trying to get people to even come to the stand-up special taping, that was hard. Like, it was hard to get people there. The first show was a little bit easier because it was like my mom's friends and my friends and some family. But trying to get people to come to that second show, man, it was tough. Like, there's only 80 people in the room, you know, but like it was hard to get people to show up.
Hard how? Explain hard how. What were you doing?
HBO, you know, I was telling everybody and handing out flyers and doing all that stuff. And so there was a lot of that was cut out because it didn't make sense in the timeline of what we were trying to achieve. But then HBO has like a person whose job it is to get people to go. And that's why the whole thing was expedited. We pitched it to HBO in June and we started shooting it in August. It was expedited because the summer ends and that's when everybody goes home. So it's because it's a tourist town. This was towards the end of August. The summer was starting to end and people had started to go home already. So it was just hard to find people who even had an interest in seeing a comedy show because the town shrinks so much, the population. And so HBO's person who they hired to try to get people to show up was like having to go like hit up tattoo parlors and 2 hours away in Mobile or Pensacola and say like, hey, there's like an alternative comedian doing a comedy special. Would you mind telling your clients to look into it? You know, that's the kind of shit they were having to do. It was really simple. It was like a street team, like something I would have done as a kid to try to get people to come see my band play. I felt very old school.
The loss of a parent shapes people differently depending on their age. You were obviously younger than your older brother. When you start rummaging around in some of this stuff, how does he experience it?
He has a different experience completely because he experienced her for 5 more years than I did. So he got to see my mom as more of a successful musician. And then got to see her make the conscious choice to go be just playing in bars and doing covers and stuff like that. Whereas me, I never saw the first part. So to me, it was like she doesn't have a choice. That's kind of the way that I always thought about it. My brother has a view of my mom that she was like a little bit more in control than I was. My view of her, you know, he says in the thing, like, I only saw this one version of my mom, whereas he saw like, there's just more of an arc to my mom, whereas I always joke that you got 5 more good years than I did, because by the time I rolled around, things had gotten kind of a little bit darker, and her problems and my dad's problems were pretty extreme, you know? So we, you know, my brother got to grow up a little bit more before things kind of went south, or got messy, as I like to say.
Less damaged?
Yeah, he's less damaged, for sure. My brother can very easily go like, no, I don't like that. Whereas I'm kind of like, oh, maybe, you know, he has better boundaries and stuff, you know.
Less funny too, though, right?
Yeah, probably.
Like vastly less funny because, I mean, I don't know what percentage of comedians are happy-go-lucky, but I haven't met a whole lot that don't do what your therapist says you shouldn't do, which is deflect and find the funny because it feels better than being in pain.
Well, yeah, I mean, and he's another huge part of like my comedy. Going back, I realized like he would let me hang out with all of his friends, his who are older than that. You don't want to hang out with a 10-year-old when you're 15. But I was like, I got to get really good at skateboarding. I got to start surfing. I got to listen to punk music. I got to do all this stuff so that when shit goes south with my mom and I don't have a place to stay, I can go stay with my brother and his friends. And so I was and then I would constantly do things like I remember getting into the car ride, like if we were driving to a show. I didn't have any rules as a kid. Like my brother kind of raised me, you know. So like he wanted to go see a band play in Birmingham, which was 5 hours away, with his friends, and I was like, "Can I go?" And he said, "Yeah, you can go, just be cool." And I was like, "Okay." So I knew that they were gonna make fun of me in some kind of way, and I was like, "All right, I gotta figure out how to control it." So I, right when I got into the car, I was just like, you know what I feel like doing is just sucking a big and then for the whole trip, they just made fun of how I randomly said that. And they're like, why did you randomly say, you know, oh, well, Whit, you know what he wants to do is suck a big oh, I'm hungry. Should we go to McDonald's? Well, Whit, all he needs is a big to suck on and he'll be okay. And they were making fun of me the whole trip. But I remember thinking, like, I started this. Like, they're making fun of me on my own terms.
I really appreciate the vulnerability. The special is a work of art. Congratulations on it. I hope it opens up the doors that need to be opened so that you could be still desperate, because it sounds like you need to be desperate, but as funny as you are, because you're really talented. So thank you for sharing your story with us, and thank you for making that special the way that you made it.
Dude, thank you so much. It really means a lot that you connected and wanted to talk to me. I really appreciate it, man.
Likewise. Thank you, sir.
Hey everyone, it's Mike Ryan. Thanks again to Whitmer Thomas, the star of HBO's The Golden One. And make sure to check out that album. It's actually really good. I know there's a lot of funny lyrical content in it, but Songs from The Golden One is actually an album I've listened to several times over since this stand-up comedy special was released on HBO Go. Make sure to check that out. Speaking of checking things out, make sure to check out the rest of the Levitard and Friends Network menu. We put out a lot of menu items for you, the listener. I know times are hard right now, but we still want to keep putting out content at the same rate. In fact, we're doubling our efforts in many respects. I know they aren't Stupidity. Stupidity is a look inside of the weird, bizarre world that Stu Gatz is the king of. So make sure to check that out. Also, outside of the Levitard and Friends Network, Bomani Jones, you know him from Highly Questionable, High Noon, Around the Horn. He has an amazing podcast in his own right, The Right Time with Bomani Jones. Make sure to support Bomani because he's a great supporter of what we do. And the Mystery Crate has carved out a nice little identity for itself here recently, especially on the heels of a highly controversial interview with then Southeast Tulsa College strength and conditioning coach Tim Jerns. A lot of extra ears came over to the Mystery Crate since then. So you may want to subscribe to the Mystery Crate, listen to the first Tim Jerns interview, because there's a sequel coming out this week.